Okay, I want to thank Barbara Cohen and Peter for inviting me here. And in fact, I believe that it's the first time I've been back at Irvine since, I don't know when, maybe 1994, which is when I got my degree. Yeah, that's good. But in some way or other, my training here in comparative literature at Irvine is responsible for, you know, starting this trajectory from literary studies to thinking about literacy in a much larger framework, namely the framework of image and now especially information technologies. So it's nice to be back. Okay, what I'm going to do is talk about an even newer project than any of the three that Peter mentioned, which is a project on poetry and an effort to think about, finally to, can you hear me okay? Is that fine? Yeah. Finally to get to the topic of digital textuality, which is something I've been avoiding for a really long time. Partly because I just didn't find enough of interest there, and maybe because I had other things to do also. So I'm going to be talking a little bit today about a kind of genealogy. I mean, this is not me coming up with this, but following in the wake of some other work, a genealogy of digital textuality from modernist poetry that has as its overriding interest and aim the effort to take very seriously the work, and I'm not sure if it's sophisticated cognitive work, as Kay Hales says it is, but the work that the computer is doing, and think of the computer as something other than simply a new technical support for reading, the process of reading and textuality as it's always been. Okay, so that's the aim here. I want to say a little something. I'm going to first say a few things about information and the humanities, since that's, after all, what our topic is here. And since we talked about the newness of the new media this morning, as I just said in the commentary to Ale's paper, you know, I agree with Lev Manovich and others that the computer does represent something new. And it seems to me that the combination of the history of media and the history of computing in this device has done something more than simply introduce one more form of new medium, right? So I think that's very, very important. And I also agree that the term new media is not a bad term because it actually tries to foreground exactly that, or it does foreground exactly that. But for me, what's missing in the discussions of culture and technology that we've heard so far is the note of reception. And that is the correlation of the flexibility of information and the specificity of information via the role of the user, participant, reader, depending on what kind of interface we're talking about, in co-creating whatever image or object is going to be the aesthetic object of an experience, right? So that's exactly what I was interested in thinking in terms, in very general terms, in New Philosophy for New Media, namely the way that the flexibility and lack of inbuilt structure or form in the new media brings to the fore something that's always been with us, which is the necessity for a creative collaboration between the human and the technologies that construct cultural objects. So this, to me, is the key to the role of the humanities in information culture, right? The insistence on the reception dimension and the human reception dimension, the selection that goes into the process of reception that's foregrounded in this process, right? And so all of my work now I see as belonging to a kind of argument about the technogenesis of the human, which is really going to be the work of that book called Becoming Human, which is a theoretical book about the human, and it's really an argument that we have always been post-human because the human as a species is the form of life that evolves not only through genetics but through the passage of information culturally, right? So the passage of ourselves culturally, and this is already present in the very proto-origin of the human where we find fossil evidence of humans at the same time as evidence of tools, right? Flint tools that involve actually a very sophisticated technical culture. So the role of the humanities is to first insist that there is no sort of opposition between the human and the technical, rather the human has always been technical, and then to become more activist in kind of the John Guillory mode, making knowledge claims, in talking about information and disputing what information is. Okay, so on to digital poetry. As I said already, I think poetics holds the potential to exploit the specificity of the computer as a partner in the literary act, and to actually exploit things about the computer that are specific to it, right, that are different from the way human reasoning functions. And here I believe I'm taking a distance from my friend Kate Hales, who tells us that the computer is performing sophisticated work, and by that she seems to mean in the actual interpretive reception of the work, and that's something I never could agree with. So we'll see what comes out of this reading. And to affirm a point made earlier by Tara McPherson in a slightly different context, and she's interested in the, I'm sure she's also interested in literary text, but in digital literary text, but she's interested specifically in the knowledge production of the academy, and to, it's even a bolder claim there, I think, than in relation to poetry, but to really take seriously the affective and sensory dimensions of reading and the way that language works beyond semantics defined at least in a narrow sense. Okay, so my work in this project is following in the wake of Los Pequeño Glaser. Many of you will know his work or his book, Digital Poetics. He has argued in quite general terms, and there's a need for people to come in and do more work here, that digital textuality and the theorization of digital textuality has overlooked poetry in its canonization of hypertext. And he's made a distinction between a first generation of digital authors who were concerned with narrative to a newer generation of authors who are concerned with poetic models. And he suggested, and this may be a little schematic certainly, but he suggested that this marks a kind of material shift in what it is digital authorship is and what a digital text is. Specifically, this shift and the work of the newer authors in this argument taps the potential of software that was developed in the 1990s. And that's the way, at least one way, in which it will do justice to the specificity of the computer. Glaser's inventory of computer ontology stresses how the digital itself is material, although in a more flexible manner than print. So he variously demonstrates how code expands the material properties of language, how what he calls the underworld of actual markup or programming language yields a plethora of new fields to be furrowed, and finally how, more radically still, the operation of programming and real-time action open new registers of possibility for the text, possibility for the non-semantic, the spatial, the polymedial, and at the limit for live execution in the reader's presence of forms that offer experiences in textuality, a world apart from the rigidity of fixed paths through a textual field. Sorry about all this PowerPoint language, but it's the way that I cannot actually read to you the paper that I was going to read to you, but since everyone's been talking, and I like that better anyways, this is the payoff, my crutch, technical crutch. So, for Glaser, there are two foundational claims about poetry. First, an ontological, or for me, reading Glaser, an ontological claim. In contrast to the sequential reading order of hypertext, poetry offers a more granular approach. A true digital text is one that is highly sensitive in every grain of its service. This practically defines innovative poetry, the ability for any word or character to be part of the action of the text, right? So this notion of operating at the granular level or at the level of the letter, as we're going to see in the example John Cayley's Overboard that I'm going to focus on towards the end of my talk here, as a kind of example and a very important example for the kind of potential of the computer as a new home for experimental poetry. And the second claim is an information theoretical claim, namely that poetic writing and reading is a form of selection on a background, selection against a context, right? And that context, as I'm going to argue it, is going to become very very much the embodied context of reception thought in a very broad sense. So Glaser says, rather than focusing on the information of the text, poetic practice has explored the conditions of meaning-making. Okay, so this then brings us again back to humanities and information culture. Okay, so inspired to some degree by Alan Liu's monumental effort of reading all of these business manuals and attempting to characterize for us in his book, Laws of Cool, the Discourse Network 2000, right? The sort of way that that language has been instrumentalized for the values of efficiency. It seems to me that it's very important for us as humanists to contest the definition of information, right? Now more than ever, right? And this means contesting the technicist paradigm of information, which for me is exemplified by certainly not by the people that Lev Manovich was speaking about earlier, but by someone like Claude Shannon, and only maybe by part of Claude Shannon, namely the idea that information and understanding what information is need only concern the sort of, you know, that famous diagram of the sender, the message, and the receiver, right? And so the technical problems involved in turning that process into the most efficient kind of a process and to describing it in probabilistic terms, right? Now, I want to argue that we need to, against that technicist paradigm, and again, in line with something that Tara said earlier, which is the need to foreground content in developing of these tools, right, and the specificity of a particular project as instrumental to how the technology will be used, seems to me we need to reassert the crucial role of meaning as something that's imminent to information. And I have already done that and tried to do that in my book, so I'm really sort of just repeating myself here. But I think it's important that we think of this as critical work and as knowledge production that we in the humanities are doing. So to do this, as those of you who have read the chapter in my book on information theory will know, I turn to this guy Donald McKay, who's a British cyberneticist coming out of participating in the early Macy meetings and attempting to supplement Shannon's model, mathematical model of communication, with a theory of meaning, right? And it's a different theory of meaning than the one that Warren Weaver develops as a kind of supplement to Shannon's picture, because it asserts that meaning isn't something added on after the fact to information theory. It's something that's always built into information theory, right? So for McKay, the effort is to give a whole theory of meaning, as he puts it. And he makes an important distinction between selective information content and descriptive information content. Selective information content being more or less what Shannon is talking about in his technical definition of information, right? The number of binary steps needed to specify a certain message, right? Descriptive information content is the contextualization of that probabilistic process against a background, right? And that's always a semantic background, right? And for McKay, it's a semantic background that's richly and robustly embodied, since it involves all the dimensions of the receiver's singularity. He talks in very specific terms about visceral responses and hormonal secretions of the receiver, right? So for McKay, this is built into, right? It's imminent in what information is, right? So it seems to me this is, and it seemed to me, and it has been a very useful model for me as a humanist in trying to start doing some of this work, contesting the value of information in our culture. So the key claim in relation to digital poetry is going to be that by potentializing the granularity of language as a background for the selectivity that constitutes the meaning of a poem, the computer works by expanding this descriptive information content that allows us to specify the meaning of a piece of information, of the selective information content of a message. So how does this position on information theory translate into the domain of poetics? We have some assistance from the concrete poet and theorist Geraldo de Campos, who wrote a very interesting article called The Informational Temperature of the Aesthetic Text. And de Campos, following Bernard Mandelbrot, actually, who's written a paper on the informational temperature of the linguistic text, de Campos makes a distinction between two dimensions of language: the linguistic statistical and the aesthetic. And he talks about, again, following Mandelbrot and adapting Mandelbrot, the informational temperature of a text, right? And this is of a linguistic statistical text, right? It is low if redundancy is high. It is high if redundancy is low. Okay, so James Joyce is the example of a high informational temperature where you have very little redundancy, right? And that's why Joyce is so difficult, right? The language of children, which is very repetitive, is an example of a text with, you know, or language of low informational temperature where there's lots of repetition and redundancy, right? So de Campos proposes that what concrete poetry is as an aesthetic project is an effort to introduce an aesthetic transposition of the text to make the informational temperature of the linguistic statistical dimension of the text a function of its aesthetic intentions. Okay, so in other words, to subordinate the information, informational temperature, the quotient of redundancy, if you will, to the aesthetic purposes of a text. So this gives us the program of concrete poetry, which could be reductively stated like this. Keep informational temperature at the minimum necessary to obtain the aesthetic achievement of the poem. Okay, so reduce the linguistic temperature, so the lack of redundancy, right? The information value in purely linguistic terms to the lowest amount so that you can shift the focus from that dimension of semantics, right? Linguistic semantics, to something else, namely the aesthetic. Okay. So how does this manipulate information temperature of an aesthetic text? It specifies the aesthetic as concerned with meaning in a broader sense than the semantic dimension of language. Okay, so semantics is no longer the meaning of the words in the text, but it has another dimension, and here it's obviously going to be the visual layout of the text, and I'll show you a couple examples just in a second. It employs the procedure of reduction that has a specific aesthetic aim, namely specification on the aesthetic matrix of the visual. So the descriptive information content here, if you will, becomes the visual, right, as something broader than simply the linguistic content of the text. So rather than producing a reduction of language, concrete, which is what concrete poetry is always criticized as, concrete poetry is a reduction of vocabulary within a syntax of the analogical visual type. So it's an aesthetic transposition of a text into a new form on a new background, namely the analogical visual. Yields text with low information temperature, high aesthetic value, although the aesthetic value is not coming from properties of the language, but from the way the words look on the page, in distinction to Joyce. Okay, so here's a poem by De Campos, right, where you certainly have low informational temperature of the text and high aesthetic value. Right, at least if you like concrete poetry, I suppose. Okay. Another simpler example from Gomringer, right, where the kind of patterning of the words on the page, these are very simple examples, takes precedence over the meaning. Okay, so there's an emphasis on the dynamic engagement with the generation of the semantic, and I think I'll just skip this very long passage. So what's the payoff? Okay, it specifies how the granularity of poetry supports a different reduction of linguistic informational temperature than, say, Ogden's Basic English, right? That project to reduce the English language to the 850 most used words, right? And hence to make it an easier system in the sense, or a clearer system in the sense that you use only the words that appear the most, right? So you maximize redundancy, right? So you can think of that as one effort to specify the context for the informational value of the linguistic text, and I think you can think of concrete poetry as the opposite, right? Namely, recontextualizing language in a new domain, namely in the domain of the visual and the analogical. So the reduction yields a certain quotient of aesthetic information that correlates with the deployment of language as a non-semantic generative material with the what I want to call the pure potentiality of language, right? So it taps into a non-semantic, at least if we define semantic in the narrow sense of what the words actually mean, a non-semantic dimension of the text. Okay, a more complex, I argue that this is a kind of proceduralism, and I'm interested, I mean, this lineage, and this resonates with Noah's paper clearly. The lineage in poetry, for me, that's most important for the digital is the procedural. And so a more complex proceduralism is that of Jackson McClough, the American poet, who in fact ended up embracing computerized computerizations of his procedures, his diastic and acrostic procedures, but not embracing them as kind of black box machines for just generating more poetic text, but really embracing them as something that he then, as the poet, can respond to and do something new with. And that's going to be important to me, that kind of second order dimension of McClough's proceduralism. I'll explain that in a little minute. So, McClough, as an example, complicates the default new media understanding of the procedural as simply the database plus algorithm, right? Which is how you see it defined many places. And it does so specifically by inserting and insisting on the fact that the creativity is in the creative role of reception, right? So it's, as I'm going to put it a little later, the text and the procedures making the text, even if they are chance procedures, remain completely deterministic. The non-deterministic comes from the embodied response to the text. Right? So he employs the chance acrostic method and also the chance diastic method. The acrostic method is selection of an index sentence that is then spelled out acrostically using words selected by predetermined chance operations, opening a text, reading until an encounter with a word beginning with the first letter of the index sentence, and so forth. Okay, so here's an example. Call me Ishmael. So you see the first line has the words, if you take the first letters of all these words, it spells call, the second line me, the third line Ishmael, and so this is composed simply by going through a text that's chosen randomly, finding the first word that begins with C, writing it down, continuing, finding the first word that begins with A, writing it down, finding the first word that begins with L, and so on. Another one, hipsters aren't happy people, okay, same principle. So what's the relation to information theory? Well, it parallels McClough's procedure of composition, parallels Shannon's method for representing probability structure, the probability structure of an informational source. Shannon proposed that you select a book off the shelf, open it to a random page, select a word, select another book, open it to a random page, select a word, and so on. Both of these employ chance procedures that capture the statistical structure of language, and that's what Shannon's trying to do in his example. The way that they capture the statistical structure of language, as we've now learned from research on cryptology, embodies the difference between the frequency of recurrence of characters, or of redundancy, in random language and in natural language. Okay, in random code and in natural language, I guess. 4% versus 7%, right? And cryptologists have shown that codes encrypted using any natural language are much easier to de-encrypt, right? To decode, because of this 3% difference in redundancy. Okay, so McClough's work taps the potential of the margin of redundancy that characterizes natural language, namely that 3% that differentiates it from purely random language. Okay, and this is for other purposes, really, but this is an effort of me to respond to an objection by my friend Sandy Baldwin, and I think it's a very good one, which is that the semantic is actually inside already of Shannon's theory, right? And I think that's right. To the extent that Shannon's theory works with natural language, and that Shannon is thinking this in terms of natural language, in this margin of redundancy that characterizes natural language, there's a kind of potentiality to the semantic, right? A potentiality to be semantic that's already there in information. And there, again, the humanities right there in the middle of information science. But that doesn't concern us so much right now. Like concrete poetry, McClough deploys the selection procedures in the service of an aesthetic transposition of the linguistic statistical. His aim is to deploy, according to me, that is, to deploy the redundancy that occupies the 3% difference between random and natural language toward the production of aesthetic value. Okay, so I want to now turn briefly to what, I have about 10 minutes or something, is that right? Left or less than that?
Five.
Okay. Well, let's see. Let me just explain these poems, then I want to talk about the Cayley example. In The Pronouns, A Collection of 40 Dances, these are poems that are composed diastically using a set of index cards that have gerundial phrases of actions, right, and kind of funky actions. And then what McClough asked, these were actually supposed to be scores for dances, and so he asks his performers to then actualize these poems, and maybe I should show you one. Yeah, okay, here's one. So the poem then is supposed to be the score for an action, and a dancer is going to take this and actualize it in a way that is specifically singular to that dancer's response, right? So he emphasizes very much how the dancer has to make all these decisions about what to do, right? And the payoff really here is the notion of this kind of second order dimension of these poems that, for me, vastly broadened the matrix on which aesthetic transposition occurs. In contrast to concrete poetry, which remains static, here it is the double transposition to the gestural as the actualization of embodied potentiality that's important. Right? And again, as I said earlier, the contrast between deterministic chance operations in the construction of the text and then the non-deterministic dimension of this acting out of the poems builds that kind of non-determination of reception into the actual aesthetic object. And that's important. Right, so Potentiality can't be entirely embedded in a procedure which remains deterministic, but must be associated with the singularity of embodied perception, with the entirety of descriptive information content spanning the aesthetic transposition, that is, both the poem itself and also those processes of its actualization. Okay, so it's kind of allegory for this notion of reception as I'm talking about it. And here, obviously, all poems that would be simply getting the computer to do sort of computational processes, right, would be simply deterministic. Right, and probably not that interesting, according to me. Okay, Cayley. You guys are probably familiar with John Cayley. He's a British contemporary poet, a very interesting, one of the most interesting people working in the digital, in the realm of digital poetry. And what he does is he seeks to instantiate this potentiality, or according to me, this potentiality of language that informs the materiality of the text. And he does this by foregrounding the correlation of information in the text at a given time and information that forms the context of selectivity that yields the text. And he does this specifically by what he calls transliteral morphing, which is a process of, he takes a text, and in the example, maybe I should just show you the example. Okay, this is a text called, maybe I should not have it, called Overboard. And what he's done is he's taken a text which is four stanzas of a text recounting from Governor Bradford's Up Plymouth Plantation, recounting an episode in which someone falls overboard on a ship and then is rescued. Right, so he's taken these four stanzas and he's created a word conversion chart, a letter conversion chart, where associated with each letter from the source text is a letter that has some kind of aesthetic similarity to it, and he has the text then go through in three stages. Which he calls surfacing, floating, and drowning, a kind of continual movement from the source text to its, you know, complete decomposition into these alternate letter arrangements. And there, the permutations are not infinite, but they're certainly very multiple. And he then also has... So what he's doing is he's attempting to use the computer as what he calls a programmaton, right, that is going to exploit the capacity that it offers to play at the letter, at the level of the granularity of the text or of language or the level of the letter, right? And he then sort of reiterates this the importance of what he calls literal art, right, against graphic art. I mean, in the essay that he wrote for Noah's book, where he suggests that what graphic art does is simply takes, by being interested in the pixel and so on, it simply takes the computer and what the computer can do and submits it to something that's already familiar to us, which is the visual register, right? And that something more radical, a much more radical potential, comes from operation at the level of the letter and what he calls literal art. And I think to reinforce this message, he has this part and the sound part of the piece, which was meant to be a multi-platform piece shown in an art gallery, hung on a wall, but also then on the computer screen. And this is these are little pieces of, you can't even see them, they're unreadable, right? Pieces of an image of the surface of the ocean, right? And they're turned into discrete units, just the way letters are discrete units, at least typed letters in this form, you know, in certain kinds of text. And then the sound is done by a friend of his who generated a kind of sound that goes along with the action of the text, whether it's in one, which of the three states it's in, surfacing, floating, or drowning. And then also, as you'll see when the cursor comes in, is keyed to movement through these little units of the visual image. So what he's doing here is submitting the analogical process of viewing to this literal recomposition and the analogical process of hearing to this literal recomposition, right, in a way to bring home this message about how interesting it is, this potential that the computer gives us for the kind of literal transposition, aesthetic transposition of the source text and its semantic meaning onto the play at the letter of the level of the letter, or the play through the transliteral flux that, according to Cayley, underlies language. Right. So the way he thinks of language is as this kind of process of transformation where legibility surfaces every so often. right? And that's something that's brought home in a kind of material way by the capacity of the computer to support this kind of transliteral flux. I think I rather than going back and saying anything else, I think I would just stop right there.